Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Welcome, everybody, to the Parsha class for Toldos 5772. We are enjoying a little time off the Thanksgiving holiday, and I'm very thankful that you are all here today to learn with me. A short reminder that we have begun a new approach this year to our class, which will feature, God willing, a handout sheet each week with commentaries from a particular sage within the last 1,000 to 1,500 years, shall we say. Our goal this year is to discover and to explore what has become known to us as Da'as Torah, Torah knowledge, Torah wisdom. I've always tried to share Torah wisdom, but what I'd like to do this year is go back to the sources and actually excerpt for you the sources that I would be studying to present a class and to make it like a text-oriented one. Hopefully it will still generate thoughtful discussion after we read the excerpt. So every class will feature one verse from the Parsha, followed by our excerpt. And today I chose Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, a leader of Torah Jewry from Germany. His life was from 1808 to 1888. I just decided to excerpt something, a short description of him, from Rabbi Beryl Wine's website. Rabbi Beryl Wine, the famous historian. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch lived when everyone believed that Orthodox Judaism was dying and reform was the wave of the future. Look at the dates and you'll see that that was the period. Almost single-handedly, he proved them wrong. With the power of his leadership and writing, he turned the tables on the reform movement, showing Western European Jewry that it was indeed possible to be both a worldly intellectual and a pious Jew. What I'm going to share with you from Rabbi Hirsch's commentary on the Torah is something which I think has become very popular. It is a little bit progressive in its type, in that it actually raises a criticism against a pair of our patriarchs and matriarchs, Yitzchak and Rivka, for the way that they raised their children. But what Rabbi Hirsch writes has become mainstream thought in the Jewish, in the Torah world today, in the area of chinuch, in the area of raising children. So the theme of this class is chinuch, raising children, and our source is Rabbi Raphael Hirsch's, Samson Raphael Hirsch's commentary on the Parsha of Toldos. The verse that we will quote is from Bereishis 25:27. If you care to look at that in the original, that would be page 126 and 127 in the English. The Parsha begins with the birth of twins to Yitzchak and to Rivka after many years of praying, of davening. And the Torah charts the twins' life from the womb and then continues on into childhood. So the verse says, Vayigdalu hanarim, Vayhi Esav ish yodeat sayid ish sadeh, V'yakov ish tam yoshev ohalim. The lads grew up. Esav became one who knows trapping, a man of the field. But Yaakov was a wholesome man, abiding in tents. I would never detect any note of criticism in this seemingly innocuous narrative of the children. Let us turn now to Rav Hirsch's commentary, and he does note something critical here. Our sages, who never objected to draw attention to the small and great mistakes and weaknesses in the history of our great forefathers. Sorry, just let me prepare you. Rav Hirsch wrote in German. It was translated, I'm sure, decades ago. One of the characteristics of his writing is very, very long sentences. This is not a grammar class, and it is not my job to judge whether his style of writing or the translators is in keeping with the rules of grammar. But
German writing?
Was it German
writing? Yeah.
So that was the style of the German. Okay, that makes that would make a lot of sense then. Okay, so we'll just try to go slow, and please let me try to read through the whole excerpt. Please stop me if you want to clarify something immediate, but otherwise we will have discussion afterwards. So again, our sages who never objected to draw attention to the small and great mistakes and weaknesses in the history of our great forefathers, and thereby make them just the more instructive for us. Here too, on Vayigdalu, the words Vayigdalu, which mean and they grew up, make a remark which is indeed a signpost for all of us. They point out. So I think Rabbi Hirsch is attributing his comments to the sages. This is not his own personal interpretation, perhaps. They point out that the striking contrast in the grandchildren of Abraham may have been due not so much to a difference in their temperaments as to mistakes in the way they were brought up. As long as they were little, no attention was paid to the slumbering differences in their natures. Both had exactly the same teaching and educational treatment. This is what is inferred from the phrase Vayigdalu hane'arim, the lads grew up. And the great law of education, Chanoch l'na'ar al pi darko, bring up each child in accordance with its own way. And that is a quote from Shlomo in Proverbs, was forgotten. That each child must be treated differently, with an eye to the slumbering tendencies of his nature, and out of them be educated to develop his special characteristics for the one pure human and Jewish life. The great Jewish task in life is basically simple, one and the same for all, but in its realization is as complicated and varied as human natures and tendencies are varied, and the manifold varieties of life that result from them. Okay, let's just take a pause for digesting this. This really fits in with the idea that we've spoken of many times before about the klal and the prat. We all share a common purpose, a common life force, and a common destiny. And we Jews who live by Torah specifically just read the Shema, and we're all subscribing to that basic type of life. And yet, being that each of us is unique, we are pratim, we are individual parts, not just smaller, but different. We're not just different screws in the machine, but each one is a unique screw, if you will. Therefore, the task of education is completely individualized, even as it is bringing us to the same collective destiny. Rabbi Hirsch is pointing out that from the phrase Vayigdalu hane'arim, that they grew up without attempt to differentiate, that's what led to the later half of the pasuk, which says they grew up totally different. Maybe they shouldn't have grown up so different had they been given the particular, the individualized type of chinuch that they should have. When Father Jacob visualize the tribes of our nation in the sons standing around his deathbed, he saw not only future priests and teachers, he saw around him the tribe of Levites, but also the tribes of royalty, of merchants, of farmers, of soldiers. Before his mental eye, he saw the nation in all its most manifold characteristics and diverse paths of life. And he blessed all of them. And ish kavir chaso berachosam, each according to his specialty, with and in his different path in life, did he bless them. He is referring to the Parsha of Vayechi, where Yaakov gives each of his sons a special and a unique blessing. For the covenant which God established with Abraham wants to win a whole national life, a whole, fresh, complete life of a nation with its manifold classes and occupations, all for the one and same great task of life, Lishmor Derech Hashem, La'asos Tzedakah U'Mishpat, I would translate, to observe the path of God and to practice righteousness and justice. There, strength and courage, no less than brain and lofty thought and fine feelings, are to have their representatives before God, and all in the most varied ways of their callings are to achieve the one great common task of life. In fact, we could say that the requirement to develop individualized paths are necessary in order to reach that common goal. Just like, okay, you would not, if we all got together and said, let's build a hospital, because that's something that we need as a society. Well, you're never going to build that hospital if all you have on your team are doctors. So we need variety in order to reach that wholeness. So the same thing here with the Jewish people. With a task so profound as to guard the way of Hashem and practice righteousness and justice, that is such a broad-based concept that we need different players and different team divisions. But just because of that must each one be brought up al pi darko, according to the presumed path of life to which his tendencies lead, each one differently, to the one great goal. So this is realized, this development is realized from the very early path of a child. To try to bring up a Jacob and an Esav in the same college, make them have the same habits and hobbies, want to teach and educate them in the same way for some studious, sedate, meditative life, is the surest way to court disaster. A Jacob will, with ever-increasing zeal and zest, imbibe knowledge from the well of wisdom and truth. While an Esav, what's bubbling inside of him as he sits in those classes of Talmud or whatever, he can hardly wait for the time when he can throw the old books. But at the same time, a whole purpose of life behind his back, a life of which he has only learnt to know from one angle and in a manner for which he can find no disposition in his whole nature. So he associates the Torah with resentment. Had he been taught to look at the Torah from his vantage point, maybe he would have loved Torah. Maybe he would have loved his father's path. Maybe he would have loved his brother. Maybe he would have respected him. Had Isaac and Rebekah studied Esav's nature and character early enough and asked themselves, how can even an Esav, how can all the strength and energy, agility and courage that lies slumbering in this child be won over to be used in the service of God? And the future Gibor, which means a warrior, a mighty one, which Esav was in fact, be trained to become, yes, a Gibor, but not a Gibor Tzayid. You don't have to be a mighty hunter. You could be a Gibor Lifnei Hashem. You could be a mighty one in God's army. then Jacob and Esav, with their totally different natures, could still have remained twin brothers in spirit and life. Quite early in life, Esav's sword and Jacob's spirit could have worked hand in hand. And who can say what a different aspect the whole history of the ages might have presented? But as it was, Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim, those fateful words. Can we offer you a drink?
I'm fine.
Okay. Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim, which Rabbi Hirsch says, that's the tragedy. Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim. Only when the boys had grown into men, one was surprised to see that out of one and the selfsame womb, having had exactly the same care, training, and schooling, two such contrasting persons emerge. How could this happen? How could Esav be like this? He got the same education as Yaakov. Says Rav Hirsch, that's exactly why it happened. Rav Hirsch, classic. So it's the challenge. It's the challenge of klal and prat. It's the challenge of chinuch. It's the challenge of parenting. It's the challenge of patience and of wisdom. To think that because there is some commonality, because there is some overarching moral imperative that we all must share, that must be translated into a single path. That's an error. And yet we struggle as parents, we struggle as communities, we struggle in educational institutions. We don't know exactly how to get the various personalities and characters to conform. If they don't conform, then we feel that we're not reaching the goal. So we kind of try to push them into a mold. This is educational philosophy, which is as relevant in today's age as it was in the 1800s in Germany, or as it was back in the days of the patriarchs. I would love to hear this. I think that this really, unlike some of our other ones, this is not is self-explanatory. I mean, it speaks for itself. I think we all identify with his words, and I would welcome your comments, please. Dina.
Well, I have a question. I don't have the question in front of me, but wasn't Rivka somehow told before the twins were born that it was going to be two different
Two nations grow within you, and the elder will serve the younger, or something like that.
Wow.
She should have had some sort of a hint, even if Yitzchak didn't. Yeah. One wonders if she shared it with him.
In later Midrash, it seems that Esav becomes Rome and Christianity. But exactly why,
I don't know. It's very interesting. You just reminded me of something. When on those words that Rivka was told by Hashem, the sages tell us that she sought counsel with a prophet, not her husband, but with another prophet, Shem, who was a senior. He was from even before Abraham. He just lived a long time, as they did in those years. And she was told that there were indeed two children in her womb, and that they will grow up to be two nations. Now Rashi, on the words, two nations are in your womb, Rashi comments, Goyim Kesiv, in the Torah, in the actual Torah scroll, the word Goyim is written with two yuds instead of with a vav and a yud. It's still pronounced Goyim, which means nations, but it could be in the writing could be verbalized as geyim, which means two proud ones, I believe. And Rashi says this is an allusion to Antoninus the Rebbe, Antonius and Rabbi Judah the Prince, who lived and led their respective nations at the same time, and the Talmud tells us they were great friends. Now, why did Rashi choose that slice of history to illustrate the two nations? Why didn't he, in fact, bring the illustration of the warring nations, like the Romans and the Jews? So it just dawned on me, based on what Rav Hirsch is saying. They could coexist. Here's an example. Here's a success of where people who are so different can work together as allies. When she heard Shnei Goyim Bevitnech, two nations in your womb, does that mean that they have to be at war with each other? Or could that mean that they will be allies? So then your point is just supporting what Rav Hirsch says. But I'm a little bit off on a different direction. But it does say that it wasn't necessarily in the prophecy that they have to be against each other. And that could have been the vision, realized in a successful way. Yes, Dr. Schultz.
It's clear that Esau and Jacob were not identical twins. They were fraternal twins.
Right, correct.
So given that fact, if we look at what we know about fraternal twins in contemporary life, they have the same genetic makeup, the same environment in utero and after birth. And even though there are distinctive differences in their personalities, there are much more commonalities because they are twins. To have this tremendous divergence in personalities is without precedent in history or contemporary life. And you're saying that Rav Hirsch attributes this to the fact that they got the same education, that they should have been more individualized in their education.
Right. Well, let me say this, and thank you for your question, and to come back really to Dina's point. It is fascinating, as you say, that they were so different. And they were so different. And they were inherently different.
One was red and hairy.
From physical to spiritual. Rav Yerucham Levavitz, that we spent one entire year studying his commentary, says that even before there was any cognition whatsoever, Rashi illustrates for us that Rivka used to feel a running inside of her every time she passed a house of study or a house of idolatry. She would always feel a running inside as if a baby was trying to get out. And as she learned later, the running to go to the house of Torah study was coming from Yaakov, and the running that was to go to the idolatry was from Esav. So Rav Yerucham says, we see from here that natures are inborn. So now, Rav Hirsch is not suggesting that had they gotten the right kind of education, they would have both been the same. They would have both been studious. He's saying, had they gotten the right kind of education, Yaakov would still be Yaakov, Esav would still be Esav, but he would channel his strength and his curiosity with the world and his desire for conquest or whatever it may be for benefit for Torah life.
There's a clever joke about a young boy who brings home a bad report card, and his father scolds him for the bad report card, and the child says, "Well, what do you think it is, Dad? Heredity or environment?"
Very good. Very
Listen
good.
To the son, obstetrical of side. I don't know whether they're identical or fraternal, but there's a problem, because when Esav is born, Jacob is holding on to his heel. And they should be in separate sacks, but they were in one sack.
Oh.
so that's always been an acceptable problem. On the other hand, it's true that they were a different, they looked different nature. One was red and ruddy, and
they had to be fraternal.
But doesn't the sac break before they come out?
Yes, but there's two sacs. With twins, you got two sacs.
So maybe they both broke, and then they're on their way out, and they're fighting who gets to go out first?
Yeah, it's just a story I once read about, you know. It's an obstetrical thing.
I see.
So, given that joke as a background, the answer for Esau and Jacob was it's heredity. They were born of the same parents, but their genetic makeup was quite different.
Quite different.
And any environmental influence would not really have changed them very much.
But it would, because, in other words, qualities, what Refersh is saying is that qualities are just characteristics. What you do with them isn't entirely environmental. I remember hearing that the Talmud says, if a person, maybe some of you have heard this too, if a person was born under a certain zodiac sign, that means he has a tendency for enjoying blood. I'm not sure which sign it is. So, good. So, does that mean this person's going to be a murderer? Maybe. But what if he's taught early on to be a slaughterer? Or of kosher animals? Or a mohel, or a surgeon. So the fact that a person has a love of blood is a nature and a characteristic. What he does with that is entirely subject to environment and education. And it's the challenge of the educator, A, to discover the nature, because the nature may be latent and may be very hard to identify at earlier years, but it is possible, and there may be, you know, experts that can give you guidance in that. That's A. And then B, once you find out what the nature is, now the task of Torah education would be, how do I make this characteristic fit in to a Torah life? And let this person be a successful team player on this national goal of Torah. So it's certainly a lot different. It calls for a much more extensive philosophy of educating and effort than just having everybody file in, sit down at the desk, and open up to page whatever. And that's why, you know, whose job is it to educate? Is it the school? Is it the parents? You know, both, but you can be sure that your standard school is not going to be on top of this. I mean, how can you be on top of 30 children in a classroom and yet do all of this? So it really, I think, places a burden on parents. And if the parents feel that they need help, then let the parents turn to the experts, you know, and say, what do you suggest, et cetera. But it's certainly eye-opening, and this has become over the years in almost all of the religious circles to be a bold commentary, but one that nobody has openly rejected because it's so true. It's an eye-opener. Yeah. It is.
It's extremely complicated. You know, I heard about psychologists recently. I don't know both parties at all. You have the older brother, very successful in business, very wealthy, sort of, I don't know where he stands with Judaism, but not close. Then you get the younger child who's very religious.
Mm-hmm.
Same family, same parents, mm-hmm. born at different times.
Mm-hmm.
And even within a family with children, you know, is it the middle child or the younger child, or is it the older child? You know, they're dealing with the same environment, but how they're treated could be completely different, how they feel about it. By the way, when Hirsch says, it was indeed possible to be both a worldly, intellectual, and pious Jew, This week there were 32 Rhodes Scholars named, and one is a senior at Princeton, Miriam Rosenbaum, and she's a graduate of the Brewer School in Elizabeth. She's Orthodox.
Wow.
First Orthodox woman that has become a Rhodes Scholar.
Mm.
Oh,
did you see the third one?
Bioethics.
Was Woody Allen's daughter?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, it was Woody Allen's daughter.
Well, since we're talking about child prodigies, maybe, did anyone see, and this is not unrelated to our topic, but I got an email from Fred Glusman from Beth Jacob with a link to a 9-minute or so interview about this 12-year-old composer. Has anyone seen it? There's a boy, he happens to be Jewish, Jay Greenberg. Lives in New York. He's a 12-year-old boy, and he is becoming a composer unprecedented in the last 200 years, where he is just writing entire scores of symphonies just from his head. He does it on a computer, and he will just hear the music in his head. He will sit down and he will type up a score for an entire symphony. And he's 12 years old.
There's a portion of the brain that deals with music and composition of music.
Uh-huh.
And in some people, it's hyperactive. And the paragon of that is Mozart, who in his 35 or 6 years of life made, I don't know how many compositions, 900 or more symphonies and concerti. And in some ways, it's pathologic,
mm-hmm.
because Mozart would ride in a coach and wouldn't have any paper and pencil, but he'd be composing in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And when he finally got to a place where he could write it down, he'd put it in paper.
Well,
but
this,
nonstop.
This boy is exactly that.
Yes.
He walks and he cannot help it, but he hears the music.
Well,
Jay Greenberg.
Let's take a look at this guy. It was named Jay.
Yes.
Look, Jay. Forget this music business.
Right, right.
Okay? I sent you to Yeshiva for the Torah.
Right,
right,
right.
So why are you doing this all the time?
Right.
When I want you to do this.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
What
right.
happens?
Yeah.
Especially to a piano player. What?
Yeah, you make him a nutcase.
Huh? Isn't there a Jewish thing? Mika Mozart or something? No, no, it's
not the guy. Okay, if I can say something. Naomi
sure.
has two.
Naomi, yes. Your daughter Naomi has two boys.
And Itzhakol has always been straight Torah. Zusha has been, I've said it to Mike, he could be an engineer, he could be a surgeon. This guy is very, very smart. But his studies have not been that great.
Mm-hmm.
He comes along and
music.
He knows that his grandfather will, well, we go up there and we buy them books and we go to the bookstore. But he knows that his grandfather will buy him a violin if he wants it. And out of this, he is also writing his own music.
Yeah.
Oh, this is for
very,
3 years now.
Wow.
It's very musical.
And then last night, or the night before, I was talking to Naomi, and she said, I've got 20 boys here from the yeshiva. I really wanted them to come over, and I told the boys to invite them over. They live in Muncie. And so she said, and Zusha's home, and would you like to talk to him? So Zusha gets on the phone, and I had heard music in the background. I said, Zusha, what's new with you? He said, playing violin. I said, what are you doing? I said, he said, I'm playing a piece that I composed.
Yeah. Mm.
And it sounds like a Hasidic ballad or something. He said, well, it is. It's a Rabbi Nachman Breslov.
Mm.
So this is a kid that could have gone to, had he stayed in Atlanta, could have gone to Georgia Tech and really, you know, been a top student. I know he could have. Or he could have gone my son's direction into medicine. But he didn't. But he's doing something that he really loves.
Wow.
Mondel's sister is an accomplished pianist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in the family.
It's in the family, yes.
It's that part of the brain that picks up the music.
Yes.
We ought to get grandchildren together, because one of my grandchildren, who's in the Beit Midrash program at WITS, he plays the guitar. He's composing music.
Oh, really? Okay. All right.
We have a piano player.
Well, talk to Naomi.
Yeah.
when she comes to town.
Y'all ought to get a combo together.
Isn't there something... I wish we would have more classes or something dealing with music, something about that in the future, the music would have...
An eighth note to the scale.
Something like that, and something about music even with King David and the Tehillim and the harp and so on, and what music does to the...
Dealing with Kabbalah, really. I mean, the reason we don't have more classes about it is, frankly, because we don't know a lot about it. You know,
we weren't there.
Have you composed anything?
No, me.
Yeah.
My father has composed Zmiras. You know, he's from a musical cantorial line, and when I was 12 years old. We lived in Ohio, and my father was in transition to Washington. He started working about 6 months before we moved. And on his trips, he would think of tunes for the Zmiros that you sing at the Shabbos table.
Yeah,
and he came up with a whole collection of Zmiros.
He's eighth generation of cantors.
Yeah.
Your father.
Yeah, my father's seventh, and I'm eighth. Well, if you count me.
We're looking forward to your concert.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, very much.
Anyways, you know, to conclude here, to me it's like something to dream about. You know, it's hard to implement, but it just seems to me that if once we're dreaming about, you know, the ingathering of the exiles to Jerusalem and the Mashiach, let's also dream of the day when every child and every person was able to find full expression, full comfort with his or her own unique blend of characteristics, and have that be channeled into the overall Torah life. Let's dream about that day, because that is just as important in the Torah reality, in the Torah viewpoint, as anything else. And maybe it's something of the Messianic age to aspire to, but I'm sure there's ways we can make inroads in our own lives. As you mentioned, your grandson being given the opportunity to pursue his love of music. So let us add that to the vision, the beautiful vision of what a real Torah chinuch could be.
Amen.
Thank you. Okay, Yasher Koch.
Yasher Koch.
Thank you, Rabbi Hirsch.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.